Have you ever had one of those moments where you're not just shy, but you become painfully, almost aggressively aware of your own existence?
Oh, yeah. Like the who is that moment, but deeper.
Exactly. It's kind of like when you're standing in front of a camera or maybe just looking in a mirror a little too long, and suddenly the background just fades away, and you're hit with this heavy realization of, I am here, I am real.
Right, it's jarring. The smooth automatic pilot of life just sort of cuts out.
You're stuck staring at the sheer weirdness of being a person. And then usually right after that comes the second thought, and eventually I won't be.
Right. Philosophers actually call that the broken world experience. It's when the tool breaks, the flow stops, and you become self-conscious in the most profound, sometimes terrifying way.
Well, that specific, slightly terrifying Sunday night feeling is actually the perfect entry point for what we are unpacking today. We're doing a deep dive into a lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes, and it covers this massive shift in how humans think about themselves.
It really is a massive pivot.
We're moving from the cool, calculated world of pragmatism into the messy, emotional, and frankly, kind of anxious world of existentialism.
We're going from a philosophy that tries to solve problems with logic and experimentation, that's pragmatism, to a philosophy that realizes some problems just can't be solved like a math equation. Problems like the dread of death or the search for meaning.
So the mission for this deep dive is to understand that shift. We're going to see how philosophy went from asking, does this work, to asking, why am I here? And just to give you a quick roadmap, we're going to start with the pragmatic view. Then we're going to talk about a rotten pumpkin.
Yes, stick with us on that one.
We promise it makes sense. And we'll end with a definition of truth that has absolutely nothing to do with facts.
And honestly, it's a definition that might actually change how you handle information overload today.
So let's jump in. To set the stage, Holmes starts by wrapping up his thoughts on the previous era, which was dominated by pragmatism. He brings up a guy named Richard Bernstein, who lay out five key contributions that pragmatism made to philosophy. And I'd love for you to unpack these because they sound a bit technical at first, but when you break them down, they're actually pretty intuitive.
They are. You can think of pragmatism as basically the scientific method applying to everyday life. Bernstein lists five ways pragmatism broke the old rules. And the first one is the rejection of foundationalism.
Foundationalism. That sounds like we're pouring concrete.
In a way, we were. For centuries, philosophers like Descartes wanted to find one undeniable, perfect truth, a bedrock foundation. And they wanted to build everything else on top of it logically, like, I think, therefore I am. And from that, I can prove God, the world, morality.
Right, building a skyscraper of logic.
Exactly. But pragmatism said, stop. That just doesn't exist. You can't deduce the whole complex world from a single sentence.
So they stopped trying to build a skyscraper and started building, what, a raft?
A raft. That's a great analogy. They realized we are already out at sea. Which leads right into the second point, which is fallibilism.
Which I assume means, well, that we fail.
It means we could be wrong about everything. Fallibilism is the admission that there is no logical certainty. We are fallible creatures. The pragmatist says, I might be wrong, so let's experiment and see. It's a self-corrective process, not a quest for perfection.
I really like that. It's philosophy for people who make mistakes. It feels very modern too, like the startup mentality of fail fast, break things.
Oh, absolutely.
What about number three, the social self?
So this is a big break from the Robinson Crusoe idea. The myth that we are isolated individuals on an island who can just figure everything out alone. Pragmatism, influenced heavily by Hegel here, argues that we are defined by our relationships.
Okay, so we aren't just floating in a vacuum.
Right. You aren't just you in a vacuum. You are a locus in a network of social, biological, and environmental relationships.
We're all connected. Without the network, the node doesn't exist. Got it. And that leads to number four, contingency.
Exactly. Who you are is contingent. It depends on chance. Your genetics, your environment, history, evolution, it's all a roll of the dice. There's no predestined blueprint for you. It's just what happened to happen based on a million random variables.
And finally, number five, pluralism.
Well, if you accept all the previous points that we are fallible, social, and accidental, then you have to accept pluralism. If truth is based on experience and everyone has different experiences, then there are many different viewpoints coexisting. You can't logically prove one is the ultimate winner.
So on the surface, this sounds great. I mean, it's open-minded, it's scientific, humble, democratic. But Holmes, our source material, he isn't entirely sold, is he? He has a beef with this.
He really does. And his critique is crucial because it's the wedge that opens the door to existentialism.
Mm-hmm.
Holmes points out that if you follow pragmatism to its absolute core, it relies on naturalism. And if everything is just natural, accidental, evolutionary, then there is no intrinsic value in anything.
Unpack intrinsic value for us really quick.
It means value just for being itself. In pragmatism, things have situational or instrumental value. A hammer is valuable if you need to drive a nail. A law is valuable if it reduces crime. But does the hammer have value in itself? Does a human life have value in itself, or only in how it functions in society?
Oh, I see. So it can tell you how to build a hospital really efficiently, but it can't tell you why saving a human life matters in the first place.
Exactly. Holmes argues that pragmatism misses the teleology, the big purpose. It connects theory to practice, sure, but it ignores the why behind the whole project of life. It's a philosophy of functioning, not of meaning.
And that gap, that feeling that just functioning isn't the same as actually living, is exactly where the vibe shifts. We move from the laboratory of pragmatism to the broken world of existentialism.
And this is where Holmes uses that fantastic metaphor you mentioned earlier.
It's a rotten pumpkin.
Yes. He says existentialism is romanticism turned sour.
I love that image so much. But I usually think of romanticism as, you know, poets in flowery shirts looking wistfully at mountains.
And that's exactly what it was. The Romantic era was the fairy tale. Nature is beautiful, the world is magical, the human spirit is infinite. Holmes says, imagine that Cinderella's coach. Now, midnight strikes, the magic is gone, the coach turns back into a pumpkin, and then the pumpkin starts to rot.
And Cinderella's just left standing there looking at the mess.
Exactly, the magic coach is gone. What she's left with isn't just a vegetable, it's dread. It's anxiety.
It's the morning after the party.
It's the mood of the entire era. Existentialism isn't just, I think, therefore I am. It's, I exist and I am terrified. Holmes shares a very personal story in lecture to illustrate this emotional weight. He talks about standing at his father-in-law's grave.
This part really struck me. Because he's a philosopher, you expect him to have some deep, abstract thought about the cosmos. But he's not thinking about the biology of death.
No, not at all. He looks into that dark hole where the casket was lowered, and he says to himself, next, it's me.
Next, it's me.
Wow. That isn't a scientific observation. That is emotion-loaded awareness. It's the realization of your own mortality, your own finiteness. And that feeling, that dread or melancholy, is the starting point of existentialism. It doesn't start with a formula. It starts with a feeling in the pit of your stomach.
But why did this happen when it did? Why did everyone suddenly get so anxious in the 19th and 20th centuries? Was it just something in the water?
It was the smoke in the air, really.
Yeah.
Context is everything here. This philosophy arose in an industrialized, technological society. You have the Industrial Revolution turning people into cogs in a machine. You have widespread alienation. Dehumanization. Holmes quotes a German writer, Max Scheler, who said, we are the first generation to be a problem to ourselves.
Meaning we don't know what we are, and we know that we don't know.
That is heavy, but that makes perfect sense. If you feel like a cog in a machine, you start asking, is this it? Am I just an object? So how do existentialists deal with this? Holmes mentions that you can't just use the old tools.
Right. He uses the analogy, you don't use a hammer to wash your face.
Which, just for the record, is good advice generally. Please don't do that.
Duly noted. But the point is, you can't offer a logical theory to resolve existential anxiety.
Exactly. You can't prove your way out of dread. Existentialism isn't a theory, it's a method. It's a focus of attention on existence itself.
And there's a famous phrase here that I feel like gets printed on t-shirts, but nobody really understands. Existence precedes essence.
Yes. This is the absolute cornerstone. Think of a cookie cutter. The cutter is the essence, the shape, the design, the definition. The dough is the existence, the actual stuff.
Okay, I'm with you.
For centuries, philosophers thought humans were like cookies. God or nature had a cutter. There was a definition of human nature, the essence, and we were just stamped out of it. We had a purpose before we were even born.
We were built to spec.
Right. Sartre and the existentialists flipped it completely. They said, no, there is no cookie cutter.
Yeah.
You exist first. You appear on the scene, you are thrown into the world, and then, through your choices, you define who you are. You have to invent your own essence.
Which is incredibly empowering, because you can be anything, but it's exhausting.
It's a massive burden. Sartre called it being condemned to be free, because if there's no blueprint, there's no excuse. If you mess up your life, you can't blame human nature. That's entirely on you.
Now, Holmes points out that even though they rejected the old systems, they still borrowed some tools. They looked back at Kant and Hegel.
They did, but they twisted them. They took Kant's idea that the mind structures reality, and they applied it to the inner self. And they took Hegel's dialectic, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis idea.
It's a step-by-step progress.
Exactly. But for Hegel, that was about history moving forward. For the existentialists, it's about the self unfolding. It's about moving from what they call Verhandensein, which just means being on hand, like an object sitting on a shelf, to true existence, which is authentic being.
So the goal is to stop being a thing that just sits there and start being a person who actually exists.
Precisely. But here is where it gets really interesting and where the movement splits in two. Because once you decide to focus on existence, you have two very different ways to interpret it. You have the religious existentialists and the irreligious ones.
The believers and the atheists?
Roughly, yes. On the religious side, you have people like Kierkegaard, Gabriel Marcel, Martin Buber. On the irreligious side, you have the heavy hitters like Sartre, Heidegger, Nietzsche.
And Holmes uses two plays to show the difference between these groups, and the contrast is stark. Let's talk about the grim one first. Jean-Paul Sartre, he wrote a play called No Exit.
No Exit is a masterpiece of pessimism. The premise is simple. Three people are dead. They are locked in a Second Empire drawing room. It's the afterlife. They are expecting torture devices, fire and brimstone. But there's nothing there. Just comfortable furniture and each other.
Then they realize that they are the torture.
Exactly. They torture each other psychologically. They want validation, but the others won't give it. They judge each other. It's a constant conflict. And that leads to the famous line, hell is other people.
That's such a bleak view of relationships.
It comes straight from Sartre's philosophy. He believed we have two modes, l'en soi, meaning in itself, and le pour soi, meaning for itself. Basically, I want to possess the world for myself, but the world and other people resist me. When I look at you, I realize you are looking at me. You are turning me into an object in your world.
So it's a staring contest for dominance.
Forever. It's an antithesis with no synthesis, no resolution at all, just conflict.
So for Sartre, relationships are basically impossible. But then Holmes brings in Gabriel Marcel, the Catholic philosopher, who wrote a play called The Man of God as a direct rebuttal to this.
Yes. In Marcel's play, you also have a group of people, a pastor and his family, and things are falling apart. The relationships are highly strained. Looks like another no-exit situation. But then there's a knock on the door.
A plot twist.
A parishioner needs help.
Yeah.
And in that moment of crisis, the pastor and his family realize something. They realize they have to live for others.
They stop staring in the mirror.
Exactly. And that shift from, I want this for myself, to I give of myself, changes everything. For Marcel, meaning is found in the relationship. It's what Martin Buber's called the I-thou relationship.
Yeah.
You can't be a real person in isolation.
So for Sartre, the other person is my enemy. For Marcel, the other person is my salvation.
That's the divide. The religious existentialists find meaning in connection, while the irreligious ones often find themselves stuck in that broken world with no way out.
Which brings us to the grandfather of this whole movement, the man who really started the fire, Søren Kierkegaard.
The Great Dane. And for Kierkegaard, the core question wasn't just, how do I exist? It was, how do I become a Christian?
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't mean checking a box on a census form. He meant, how do I become a person who is passionately related to the infinite?
And he lays out two paths to get there, the objective path and the subjective path.
Right. And he thinks the objective path, which is what most of us try to do, is a trap.
This is the path of evidence, right? History, logic, apologetic.
Yes. It's the attempt to prove God exists or prove the Bible is true using facts and archaeology. Kierkegaard says the problem with this path is that it's never finished. There is always a counter-argument to the counter-argument.
Holmes tells a funny story about a friend of his who was writing a book but kept putting it off because there was always one more article to read.
And he never wrote the book. That's the objective path. You're always waiting for the next piece of evidence.
Yeah.
You stand on the sidelines, observing, analyzing. You never arrive. You never commit. It's detachment.
So what's the alternative? The subjective path.
Passion. Inwardness. Kierkegaard says we aren't rational computers. We are existing individuals. And this leads to his definition of truth. And I want to slow down for this because it flips our modern understanding upside down.
Laid on us.
Kierkegaard defines truth as an objective uncertainty held fast in an appropriation process of the most passionate inwardness.
Okay, let's unpack that because that is a mouthful. Objective uncertainty.
Meaning I can't prove it with facts. I don't know for sure. The lab results are inconclusive.
Held fast in an appropriation process.
Appropriation means making it your own. You don't just agree with it, you grab onto it. You absorb it into your life.
Have the most passionate inwardness.
Meaning I commit to it with my whole heart. not an opinion I hold, it's a life I live.
So truth isn't a fact you verify, it's a risk you take.
Ideally, yes. Holmes uses the example of the Apostles' Creed. You can recite it objectively. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, like a grocery list of facts. Or you can say it subjectively, Lord, I believe.
It's the difference between reading a contract and saying a marriage vow.
That is a perfect analogy. If you demanded 100% proof that your spouse would never hurt you, never change, never leave, you'd never get married, you'd be the guy waiting for one more article.
Right. You'd just be endlessly researching.
Marriage is a risk. Faith is a risk. Kierkegaard says if you have proof, you don't need faith. Faith is the tension. It's holding on passionately despite the uncertainty. It's the passion that makes it true for you.
That is such a powerful shift from where we started with pragmatism. We went from, let's test this hypothesis to see if it works, to, I am terrified of death, nothing works, and I'm choosing to commit to this meaning with everything I have.
It really outlines the journey of the modern soul. We try to be logical machines, but we realized we are passionate, anxious creatures.
So bringing this back to you, the listener, we live in a world that is completely obsessed with the objective path. Big data. Fact-checking. Infinite information.
We do. We are drowning in the objective. We have more data than any generation in history. But are we more human? Are we less anxious?
Definitely not.
Kierkegaard would say that's because all that data means nothing if you don't have the passionate inwardness to do something with it. We are trying to solve a subjective problem, our own existence, with objective tools.
It's like we're all that friend waiting to write the book, just scrolling through one more article, one more post, waiting for the answer to appear on the screen.
But the answer doesn't come from the screen. It comes from the decision to commit.
Holmes ends his lecture with a really provocative thought that I want to leave everyone with. He suggests that existentialism kind of died in the 1960s.
Yes, it's a fascinating theory. He says the early existentialists were depressed because they thought life had no meaning. But by the 1960s, the culture exploded with too many meanings. Activism, spirituality, counterculture, careers. We got distracted by a buffet of purposes.
But here we are, decades later. We have even more meanings available to us now. We can be anything, do anything, believe anything.
And yet, look at the rates of anxiety. Look at the alienation. We are more connected than ever, yet often feel more like cogs than ever.
So the question is, do we need to resurrect this? Do we need to stop looking for objective proof that our lives matter and start practicing that passionate inwardness?
In an age of infinite data, maybe the only truth that really matters is the one you were willing to actually live out. Not the one you post about, but the one you live.
Something to think about the next time you look in the mirror and realize, I am here. Thanks for listening to this deep dive into the broken world. We'll see you next time.
Goodbye.